First of all, how do you say your surname, Dermot McKinney, is it?
Dermot, no. Listen, mate. I've got to tell you what's written on our team notice board here.
It's a bit of a running joke.
That's the question. Everyone's like, how do you say Dermot's name? Like, and so it's written, it's Mac and Ernie, like the Muppets or something like
that. So should we say, welcome to the Witwold, Dave Nicol and Dermot and Mac and Ernie.
I'm Gerardo Poli.
I'm Hubert Himstra, and this is the Witwold.
A profession in crisis. How often have you heard that in the last few years? Here's something else I heard recently. Never waste a good crisis. Now, unless you've had your head buried in the sand, you'd know that our guest for today is not someone to waste a good crisis. Dr. Dave Nicol, author, speaker, coach, doctor, practice owner, head vet, podcaster, and founder of VetX International, finally joins us on the Vet Vault. And if you have had your head in the sand and you don't know what Dave and his team does, head to www.vetxinternational.com. That's X like X-Men, not ex-husband, where anyone interested in learning more about the sort of stuff that we talk about in this episode can find leadership resources, including articles, studies, podcasts, and training courses. Also joining us is one of Dave's teammates, Dr. Dermot McInerney. Dermot serves as the VetX International Head of Veterinary Partnerships and Research. He's the main author of the VetX Research article, Leadership Actions and Their Effects on Veterinary Practice Culture. And it's this paper that we got together to talk about. Culture. It's hard to put your finger on it, but in the setting of a vet practice, it permeates the work areas, flows into reception and beyond, and ricochets off the walls. You can feel it when you walk in the door. A long time ago, I sat in the waiting room waiting for my interview at a practice where I ended up spending many of my years. As I sat there waiting, I distinctly remember thinking, I don't like the feel of this place. It took me more than a decade to figure out that what I felt that day was a broken culture. You know what I'm talking about, right? So what do we do about it? Start by listening to this podcast. This is an episode, like so many others that we've done, that I wish I'd listened to 10 or maybe 15 years ago. But who's it for? It's definitely for anyone who owns or manages a vet practice. Required listening, I'd say. But remember, whether you're officially one of the practice leaders or not, as you'll hear from this episode, anyone can be a leader, especially when it comes to culture. But I'll stop rambling and leave it to Dave and Dermot. But before I let you go, you know that I'm going to remind you about our subscriber-exclusive series of clinical podcasts. Go to vvn.supercast.com to get the details about what I believe is the most useful ongoing clinical learning out there in Smalley's medicine, surgery, and ECC. Useful because you'll use it. And because you use it, you'll learn stuff and get more confident in your knowledge. Before you know it, you'll be that vet in the clinic. You know the one. The one with all the cool insights and who's totally up to date with what's new and what the cool kids in Vetland are doing with their patients. And if you're listening to this in the first half of January 2022, we have a bonus for you. If you join us for an annual subscription on the all-in package, we're going to gift you the most up-to-date mini-vet guide, which I think is the perfect companion to the VetVot Clinical. You've got all the thinking and tips and protocols and explanations in your ear holes, and then you've got all the doses and the flow diagrams and the crib notes in your pocket. Get your free trial before January 18 at vvn.supercast.com. And if you sign up, the mini vet guide is yours. Now, back to Dave and Dermot and culture.
You're going to use that intro, you can't change it, mate. Okay. That's
good. Right, we'll skip the welcomes then. So we're talking. Well, we're getting together tonight.
Getting a serious conversation about one of the biggest problems facing the veteran profession. Okay, so we're going to get to it. Okay, well, yeah, here you go. Go, Hubert.
Let's try and get serious. David, you've been going around to practices talking about how you help people. Dave, you talk to vets all around the world. Before we talk about our topic tonight, which is culture, there's a phrase that we're hearing all the time now. Veterinary profession is in a crisis. Are we in a crisis?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I think we're way past crisis. I honestly think we're in something of a death spiral at the minute if we don't sort ourselves out. And, you know, we started out, I think people have been calling it a recruitment crisis, and it's just like, this is not a recruitment crisis, an existential crisis. We can't have the number of people, the shrinkage in our professional populations at the same time as expansion in pet population and increases in practices opening, and not see this as a gigantic problem that's only going to stretch resources even thinner. There's not a practice in the US, for example, isn't running a vet or two short. You know, the average time to hiring is around about a year, and a massive, massive number of vacancies remain unfilled. And that wasn't like our market was in really awesome shape for a lot of practices beforehand. So, you know, we can't blame the pandemic for this. The pandemic, like it has been for so many other trends, has been like an accelerant on things that were already happening. I think we do have a big problem that we need to get to grips with very quickly. But there isn't a sudden, quick solution, unfortunately.
So do you think that, I suppose, as a profession, we were at the cusp, if not over the cusp, and then you like add on 10% workload, 15% workload all around, and that if we were a profession that was prepared or, I don't know, like had capacity, then we could have consumed and tackled that. But because it makes me think that, now just thinking about it, right? 20%, you add on 20%, all of a sudden the profession just collapses. Well, not collapses, but starts to really struggle and can't get on top and feel like they're just not treading water, but sinking. And, you know, I don't know, how did we get to that? Or why couldn't we cope with the 20% more?
I don't know. And then I think that number varies as well. You know, initially, it's funny, looking at the data from my own sources and looking at the data from the US and AVMA and Australia. Australia's a little different again. You know, I think there was this sort of notable rise. Everyone screamed about it because it felt like a notable rise. But a lot of the data suggests that it's actually just a huge drop off in efficiency, particularly in the US, because curbside became such a thing. And, you know, what might have been a 20 or 30 minute process suddenly became this drawn out thing with enormous opportunity for balls to get dropped. So if you think about the number one causes of complaints that you guys will be dealing with in your practices will be communication errors. Like everyone says, oh, it's all about the money, but it never is. It's communication of value.
You just need to be super clear about something that's really a pain point, right? So when you reiterate over and over again about the dollar, it comes across as the dollar is the emphasis.
The dollar, right. And you know, so we're wearing masks. We're socially distant or curbside. So we're reducing the number of communication tools we've got available in a group of, you know, in a cohort of individuals, of professionals that aren't actually that good at communication in the first place. Like, we're really good at passing exams. We're really good at problem solving, like figuring out puzzles. We're pretty damn good at clinical stuff as well, but we're not really that hot at communication, emotional intelligence, building rapport. And that's an area that particularly, and if you look at people who've been in the profession for a couple of decades, you think, man, like they just have clients eating out the palm of their hand. They're so good at that rapport and communication, because you have to be to survive in the service industry for very long. You look at graduates now, super smart. I mean, just scare the bejesus out of me with how intelligent they are, but also super scary how lacking in airs and graces sometimes they are with other human beings, and how quickly stressed that our graduates become, that and the airs and graces go out the window at that point. So the clients are left with this sort of bad taste in their mouth, and clients have become the enemy. So I think that was happening in any case. Put in some social distancing measures and a less effective communication flow where, you know, we're either communicating via telemedicine, like, so we're doing an interview now on the other side of the world. That's fantastic. That's mind-blowingly cool. But if we were doing an interview in person, how much more subtle cues would there be? How much more, how much richness would there be to the communication if we were not speaking through this tiny little screen here? And the answer is massive. So we've lost all of that in an incredibly intimate moment in the exam room, in the consultation process, which puts a lot of pressure. It opens up the gaps for communication to fail, and that increases stress. And also, everyone's level of certainty is just, you know, I know you guys have had it a bit easier, but of course Australia, like, I was going through a pretty rough patch recently because it was kind of playing catch up with vaccines and had sort of successfully isolated to a degree. But how do you isolate against, you know, Omicron? Like, that you can't defend against Omicron. Like, that's coming to get us all, you know, like, however mild or whatever it is. But it causes disruption, it causes uncertainty, and all of those things have created a bit of a tinderbox for, you know, an emotional struggle. And I think that's probably what we've got more than anything in veterinary medicine is, you know, we've got systemic things we've got to deal with in terms of how we're burning people out. But a lot of burnout is emotional, not physical, as you know. The physical circumstances lead to the emotional, you know, pressure and eventual burnout. So I think our system just wasn't well set up, and it was never very efficient.
Just go back, Dave. So Australia, there was an increase of pet numbers. Like the US, like, they didn't see an increase from what I understand, like in numbers overall. Is that right? Or what's the UK like?
Yeah. Okay. So I think there's questionable. I think all of this is a wee bit questionable. Hmm. It felt like it was a big increase. So everybody said there was a big increase. So everyone believed there was a big increase. Then the AVMA did some work and they said, well, actually, there isn't really that big an increase. The shelters aren't, you know, the shelters emptied, they filled up again when people were going back to work. You know, so actually they weren't seeing an awful lot of an increase like was being anecdotally reported. And I think everyone's a little surprised by that, but it's very incomplete data because they don't really track data on how many puppies are getting bred and how many puppies are going into clinics and things like that. They were tracking it from shelter medicine where they do get reliable data. And they said, actually, we're not seeing that big a change in pet population. So I think the data is incomplete at best. I can say from the practice data I've looked at, we certainly did see an increase in pet ownership, but it was more around the 5% in the UK. And that's a number I've heard, 4 or 5% from contacts within bigger corporate organizations as well. But that only pertains to puppies as much as anything. Like, it seemed to be puppies that seemed to be the popular thing to get. Sorry, kittens. Don't know why that's not. I mean, they probably do, but that's what was remarked upon. The truth is, I haven't seen anything that looks like super compelling data one way or the other. Anecdotally, my clients in Australia seem to report the biggest numbers from their practice management softwares, and that's, I've heard 20% from Australia as well.
Mm-hmm. 20% seems to be around the numbers that everyone's been discussing. So
yeah. But that may be a convenient number everybody settled on as well. So, you know, it's hard to know what the reality is. What's certainly true is we had an inefficient system, and it doesn't take a lot to tip an inefficient system. Think about homeostasis in the body. It's tiny moves out of normal for acid base and you're pretty much screwed, right? So I think our system's not as resilient as we maybe thought it was.
So many problems, but there's got to be solutions. Now,
oh yeah.
And one of the problems with this whole situation, you have this increased stress, or even if it's perceived stress, and then you have people dropping from the profession. So what you can't have is a workplace that does not try and prevent that. That's a less than ideal workplace. Because let's face it, I've been in this game 20 years. I've worked in some less than ideal workplaces. And the key word we want to get to in this conversation is culture. That's one of the things that you can influence. If you're stressed and the clients are more stressed and you're not communicating well and things are going pear-shaped and then you're working in a culture that doesn't make you feel like it's home, boom, then you're going to be gone. So let's turn this to culture. So let's before we talk about your studies and the findings, guys, and all the facts, let's philosophize a little bit first. How do you define culture? What is culture to you? Dave, I'm going to focus on you again. Dermot, we'll come to you. But what is culture?
Yeah, Dermot, go to Dermot for their numbers. That's his study, so I'm not going to crash his number study there for sure. But okay, I love this question, because when we talk about, there's a number of things that we reasons behind wanting to do this study, and we wanted to tackle some of the opacity that exists around terms like culture and leadership in general. They're kind of buckets into which a lot of stuff is chucked and talked about. But you ask 10 different people to define these things, you'll get 10 different answers. So what are some useful definitions we can put around it? And so I think culture for me is the summation of the behaviors that play out between a group of people that become the accepted norm. So it's really where, you know, where one person does something that is either good or bad, that's a behavior. That can be a problem person, that can be a toxic individual. Where that thing becomes the group, it's adopted as the group norm, group behavior, that becomes the culture. And so I like this definition because it offers us there's something empowering about the fact that if it's about behavior, and behavior all flows from values, that really gives us some useful tools as leaders to be able to go, well, actually, culture can be really, really intentional. The problem is, without a firm definition or a useful working definition, it's a question of like, well, so what do we do to influence culture as leaders? And I think beyond setting your vision, I think influencing culture is the second most important job of the leader.
So, you know, culture and setting core values and things is, you know, just a part of business 101, you know. Setting values is helpful, but then how do you tackle getting rid of people who aren't in alignment with the culture when you don't have staff?
Right. So, and this is the thing I think this was always the issue. Number one, you said something there, which is, it seems obvious when you know it and when you know what to do, like setting vision, setting culture is business 101. But for example, we know from the study we did that 45% almost of practices have no articulated vision whatsoever. And the study we did, by the way, was from two management conferences on two different continents. So these are people who are interested in leadership and management. These are the people at the top end of the spectrum. Like 45% of them had no vision. And I'm willing to bet that the other 55%, a very large percentage of those had something they'd written down on a bit of paper, sat in a drawer, box ticked, and was not a useful vision. It was a hallucination as much as anything. So I think that is job one, is to actually articulate this. I think you have to be so careful about who you let in the doors of your organization, because it does take one rotten apple to spoil the whole cart. That is absolutely true. You can have a great culture. You know, we've probably all done it, had a great culture. We made one bad hire and you're like, oh, crap, this is just... Now, it didn't make everybody bad, but the vibe just changed and you know you've got to deal with that. And if it's a values thing, good luck changing someone's values. Like that's just somebody who's, I don't have a nice, I've got an answer for you. I just don't have a nice answer, a palatable answer for you and what to do with people like that. But I'll tell you what, if you don't deal with that individual or those people, you are not going to attract people for very long into your ongoing thing, and your employer brand's going to be mush. So this is all a long-term play for intentional building of teams around a set of values which are articulated, you hire against, you train people, you set expectations. You don't just write down, hey, we value honesty. You write, well, what does that mean in our organization? And you maybe come up with three things. We're honest about the skills and the services we can deliver. We're honest and transparent about our pricing. We're honest when we screw something up and we own it. You know, okay, so maybe there's three cultural standards we can now measure performance with, and then we can get intentional.
Okay, so you define the values. Okay, you set the vision, so we all know what we're looking for and aiming towards. The values which will help us get there and align us as a team. It's like our guiding compass. And then you articulate exactly what these values look like in reality, what they look like in practice, right? It's not correct. Just going honesty, courage, and whatever, you know, like and contribution to each other, right? It's like, this is what it looks like.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And it's hard. And you mentioned, like, you know, you write down 20 values, and that's cool. You know, there's just hundreds of values, mm-hmm. and getting people to align. And when I first started doing this, I had 13 values, and I can tell you that made recruitment really hard. That's getting another human being who shares 30 values.
I struggle with thinking of the four that I picked for myself.
Right. So we have six, like all of my businesses are like, what are the six that we are non-negotiables for us? And what do they mean? And then we figure that shit out as a team. We articulate, we write it, and that's our culture code. Like, and they become principles to make decisions. And we can say, well, okay, if Dermot wants to try something out, and as part of his role, like, he wants to do some survey on this, and one of our values is innovation, then as long as he's accountable to the values, he doesn't really need to feel like he has to defend himself or justify himself. It will almost by definition be the right decision, even if it goes wrong, because he's lived a value. And I think for us, when we place such a high value on culture, we have to say, look, number one, articulate the values, write the behavioral standards so that they can become virtues, because that's what a value is when it's lived. It's a virtue. And that's when virtues are played out in real time. That becomes the culture. And it takes time. But when you do it, people start working much more harmoniously. And now the stories of how much fun it is to work in your place come out. So, you know, you can go through cultural wobbles, but if you've got the courage to address those wobbles and then articulate what good looks like, number one, people can fall in line behind that because now they've got clarity. And most people have never been told what's expected of them. Hey, what do we do here? Veterinary medicine. We show up at 9, we go home at like whenever, and we do it till the cases run out, which is never, or we fall over in a heap, which is frequently, and we're just doing veterinary medicine. And how do we do it? Well, whatever way works. And so you end up with a culture of personality, and that gets pretty toxic as everybody has their own insecurities and all this stuff gets played out in real time. And then you have a hot mess, a dumpster fire. And that's why we've got problems retaining. That's why we're, you know, it's the emotional stress of working in locations like that without support, and the structural issues of like way too much work for especially for the younger generation as they're learning and they need space to grow into their skill set. That's at the root cause of why we're really struggling.
Now, let's swing to your guys' research, to the role of leadership, obviously planning the values and hiring the right people. But what are the other things? How does the leadership team affect the culture? Obviously a lot, but how and what specifically? Did you find some things? Dermot, let's swing this to you. You guys did the study. What's your study called? I've got it written down. Leadership actions and their effect on the veterinary practice culture. So are there key standout findings that we need to know about?
Yeah, I think so. I think we found some stuff that's useful to talk about. I suppose we were obviously at these conferences and wanted to talk to leaders about their practice. And the thing that I found digging into it, is that there's loads of evidence in other branches of work. So if you look at like human nursing, for example, and sort of cultural outcomes in that as a profession, there's loads of research done on, you know, how culture affects things like patient outcomes. And we know better workplace culture improves in the human side of medicine. You get better cultural outcomes from better workplace cultures. And they've also done studies where they've implemented cultural change toolkits within nursing wards to see whether or not they make a difference. And generally across the board, they do, and they make an difference. But it's something that whenever I started looking in the veterinary sphere, although we talk about culture a lot and how that affects everyone within the practice and the work that we do, there's not a huge amount of evidence behind. So we basically decided we would go, myself and Dave sat down one afternoon and we decided we'd go to these conferences and dig into culture a little bit more and ask the leaders sort of about four different factors and see whether or not they influence culture very much. So we as you sort of touched on as well with Gerardo, is you know, do you have a clearly articulated vision for your practice in place? Do you have the time to lead your team effectively? Are you comfortable and confident in addressing staff behavior that doesn't fit with your culture, sort of would describe as inappropriate? And how do you find hiring people? Can you get people into your clinic to work there? And all four of the factors that we looked at had a positive effect on workplace culture if you could do them well. So if you had a clear vision in place for your practice, you scored your culture higher. If you had time to work on leadership work and weren't bogged down in clinical and administrative things, your culture tended to be better. If you were able to hire effectively, then your culture tended to be better. And the biggest one, and the one that had the biggest impact alone on the cultural score given, was, you know, are you able to deal with toxic and inappropriate staff behavior? And that's the biggest one that we find. So we asked them to score. It was a very simple score, scored out of 10. So how supportive do you feel that your culture is? And if you weren't able to deal with behavioral issues, on average you scored it as a 6.2 out of 10. If you could deal with behavioral issues, it was a 7.5. So you're talking over a 10% increase in your cultural score just by looking at one factor. But I think the each four of them has an influence on its own. But what was really interesting for me, and I think probably the most interesting thing from the study, was when you looked at them combined. So when you looked at the group of people who had all of the four factors in place in their practice and the group of people who had none of the four, the cultural score was distinctly different. So if you had time, if you had a vision, if you could deal with behavior and you could hire staff effectively, on average, your cultural score was an 8 out of 10. It's quite an intentional thing. You're working on a lot of leadership work. And I think anyone would be relatively happy with an 8 out of 10 on a cultural score. When people had no time, no vision, couldn't feel or didn't feel comfortable dealing with staff behavior and couldn't hire, that dropped to 5.3 out of 10. And I don't think anyone would be happy, one, with if it was your practice and it was a 5.3 out of 10, or going to work in there, or if you worked there, if you felt that your cultural score was almost, you know, half of what it should be.
Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it? You list the four like that, it sounds so nice and simple. So, oh yeah, I could do that.
Yeah.
Devil is in the details.
Yeah.
Let's start at number four with the toxic behaviors. Are there standout toxic behaviors? Again, that's a buzzword. It's a popular word, and especially in our profession, all this toxic behavior, toxic this, my workplace is toxic. What does a toxic workplace look like?
Well, this is the many-headed beasts. So I think a lot of the toxicity comes from deep-rooted insecurities, agendas that pile up, competition, stress, just emotional meltdown moments. I think a lot of where we come from is very high IQ individuals. And I'm fingering vets here as the principal people behind the toxic behavior, but that's a little unfair. Everybody is capable of not being their best selves. But when we don't have clear vision and clear values, then, you know, values drive our behaviors. You know, circumstances show up, they come into clash or they hit our values, and we interpret the circumstances in certain ways, then certain behaviors follow as a result of that. And I think at the root cause, you can look at humanity and say humanity is this higgledy-piggledy, squishy, hard to manage, very complicated, uncertain thing that's never going to be easy. Mm. Very, very hard, and I would say almost impossible to manage if your default position is, let's just see how it pans out. I think we know that there's going to regress to a mean, and that mean is going to be tribalism and, you know, infighting and agendas, and that's humanity. We're not going to change that as a mass. So I think what we've got to do is create our tribe around something very, very tangible from the outset. And that means effectively, you know, to hark back to olden times, like getting your sigil, your standard, and you know, creating it so it's very, very clear. And then boom, banging in the ground of choice and saying, this is us. This is what we stand for. This is the set of expectations we have for our team, for our individuals. We do this with standards of care, Hugh, right? Like we're actually, we don't even do it with standards of care well, because we don't like to have these conversations, and vets can't even decide what is best practice, even though we've now got evidence-based medicine. We still have our own foibles and ego and things like that. And it's always been thus in veterinary medicine or human medicine. So that's the area where we've had the best stab at it. But we bring people in, we give them a day of onboarding induction training, if they're lucky. We toss them into the environment of practice, and we let them get on with it. And if, and they bring all of their own, you know, we all bring baggage to the table. And some of us are more effective at managing that than others. So this high IQ individual called the veterinarian often brings quite low EQ, and we get in conflict. And conflict should be a healthy thing, but most often it isn't, because it becomes much more about I have to be right rather than I have to get it right. And that's that right there is one of the most important things. Like we have to, it almost becomes a never-ending competition. Like if I'm challenged, then it's important for me to be righter in this moment. And it's like, no, it's much more important we get it right. And if you're being challenged, if you're being offered feedback, for example, it's just a great example. If you offer a veterinarian feedback, you know, the emotionally intelligent, good for your career, good for your personal development thing to do is to accept the feedback, even if it was offered clumsily, because we're not very good at it, and then reflect on it, consider it within the circumstances, and put it to use in some way. You don't always have to agree with it. You're allowed to have an opinion on that feedback back. But if you're offered feedback, and good feedback is often data-based, so it's just kind of objective. The animal lived, the animal died, there was a good outcome, there was a less than awesome outcome. Let's talk about that. There shouldn't be fear of character assassination involved in that, but the way the feedback is offered is often brusque, or it's not about the behavior or the circumstance or the outcome. It becomes about the person. And we so internalize being veterinarians that an attack on our clinical skills becomes an attack on us. And the two things are not the same. But that requires an emotional intelligence to have that position, which is not easy to acquire.
It's a combination of the feedback not being objective, it's subjective, and the person who's giving it has emotion and story behind it, and potentially almost drama and not enough fact, not enough clear black and white fact. This was the situation. This was the behavior that you exhibited. This is the impact that it had that impacted me personally.
Yes. Rather than impact the circumstance.
And being perfectionists all around, veterinarians hate having feedback, despite the fact that everyone says, yes, feedback is amazing and I'll take feedback every day.
Yeah, it's absolute bullshit. There's no bigger lie in veterinary medicine than, yeah, I love feedback.
I reckon 100%. I think I've seen it like at least in a couple dozen vets. Like, oh yeah, I take feedback. Please give me feedback.
Well, and none of us like it because it is a critique of sorts. But we've got in our head, I wish we'd stop using the terms negative and positive feedback. There is only feedback. It's just information. It's the story. Use the word story. Perfect. It's the story. It's the labeling, the storytelling, and it's the emotional, you know, baggage that comes with what that means. What does that mean? It just means I'm receiving information that if I do the right thing with this, can improve my game, can improve my circumstances. And listen, I'm not immune to this. I don't like receiving feedback. I get nervous. Like I ask my team for feedback. Dermot's going to be like, "Do you hell? Like not enough, right?" But I don't like to hear it. But I've trained myself to sit in my hands and go absorb it. Let the emotional impact of that go, and then listen to the lesson behind it, because actually that'd be useful. And if I could give you one of the best examples of feedback, and this is when I lived and worked in Australia, and there was a 17-year-old, she joined the practice as a sort of, not even a trainee nurse, like almost at a volunteer level at that point. And, you know, she'd been a client at the practice. I'll shout her out, Galen, you're a superb human being. Love you to bits. Thank you for this moment, by the way, which she already knows. But I had not been my best self as a leader. We were having a tough day, and things were not going well. And I pulled the team together and I basically gave everyone a bit of a verbal. And something had happened, and it wasn't really fair. The trigger for it wasn't fair. The circumstances, we needed to up our game. The tool I picked up to try and, you know, get that to happen wasn't the right tool in the right moment. And the way I wielded it wasn't fair. And you know, when that happens, like the team's heads go down, they're not like, you know, the engagement drops off and everyone knows they've done wrong. It's like the puppy that's had its nose rubbed in poop. It knows it's done wrong. It just doesn't know why. So it's not effective feedback. Now, Galen, she's 17. She does not have an official position in the practice, but she approaches me and asks me if she can share something with me, the boss of a practice. And she shares with me the impact that what I'd just done has had on a couple of people. And she shares with me her concern about what that's done to the fabric, the culture, the relationships, and that she's got concern about that. And I was like, you know, my initial response was I wanted to smite everyone down in my righteous anger, right? But luckily I have some emotional intelligence. And I thought, Jesus Christ, this 17-year-old, who's not an employee, cares enough about this team and has the courage to come and approach the owner of the practice to offer that feedback. Like, that is a special individual right there. And it was, and that gave me enough of an, you know, curiosity, I say, is one of my secret weapons or superpowers. And I was able to move from being angry to going, oh shit, what I need to do to fix this? Because that's dead on, that's right. And I was able to make the call, apologize. It didn't delegitimize the issue we had to deal with, but the way I dealt with it did delegitimize the, you know, it took us all away from the issue and it became about the relationships, and that was wrong. So it was a matter of apologizing, you know, kissing and making up, inverted commas, and just knitting back together the threads of the practice, because caring as a leader really, really matters. And you must hold your teams accountable, but caring matters every bit as much as accountability. And that's what Galen did for me in that moment. It's one of the most powerful lessons I ever received as a leader. And from that moment onward, I was like, right, I need you at the back of every meeting. And she was like an emotional barometer. I would just look at her and sometimes she'd be like, give me the thumbs up, going, no, you're good. And other times she'd be like waving her hands down, like, no, back it off. It was so funny. And I valued that input, that relationship so much. But it was hard to initially hear because we get emotionally triggered and we all have our triggers. So if that can be somebody, and I consider myself a decent leader, geez, like when you've not had any training and awareness of it, you can see how it just explodes and it's challenging. But feedback's just feedback. We've got to learn to absorb it.
You said two words there about her that I really like. Care. She cared enough to speak up and she had the courage to speak up. Those are tough things to come by sometimes. And it probably comes back to one of the four things, isn't it? Is hiring the right people. Now, before we had this conversation, Gerardo and I were talking about the problem that we have as veterinary leaders is often you've got to find these people with high EQ, and they must care enough, and they must be courageous and curious and all the C words, all the good C words. And you've got to find them. But then we've got this shortage. We can't find people. So what do you do then? You're in this conundrum where you have to work with what you've got, because there's not like 100 people sitting at the door saying, well, we're better. I'm more emotionally intelligent than that guy who's just reacted to your feedback in a really negative way. Can you teach this? Can you teach it to people?
Yeah, no, you 100% can. You know, emotional intelligence is a skill. It's much more malleable, learnable, buildable than IQ. And I suppose we must look at this, like, I'm not sure if we go looking for, and I, you know, I do, it's one of the things we do in our recruitment process is we will test particular positions really, really need it. Like reception team members, highly emotionally intelligent reception team members are so valuable because they can manage the, you know, they've got the hardest job in the practice other than maybe the practice manager who everybody hates for a lot of the time. But the clients can be really great or really awful depending on how you work with the clients. So I think that's a role as an example. It's important, but there's no role wouldn't benefit from it. Problem is it's not in abundant supply. It is a skill. I think we need to be thinking of this in the same way as we think about clinical skills. You know, we don't necessarily have to look for people who are super high in emotional intelligence. Nice if you can find it, but good luck finding a whole team full of that. But we should be focusing time and training on building the skills of EQ and having conversations and teaching. How do we, the most important thing is, how do we address our trigger moments so that when we are triggered to be, go back to our basest of instincts, we can avoid that and divert the storm away, divert the floodwater away from the city down the appropriate channel, and we are still have a relationship basis, a basis of trust from which to address the issue. Because we mustn't dodge around the issues. And this is where conflict can actually be a really healthy trust-building thing. You know, Galen's example serves as how we should all approach this. Like, we don't have to fire toxic people. Not all toxic people are genuinely horrible toxic people. They've just not been shown what is the expectation. So if we do, if we care enough courage, just like Galen, when we're addressing and offering feedback, we are caring and having courage to have those conversations. Galen modeled to me exactly how all of us can address the toxic behavior in our teams. Dermot, can I have a word? I want to talk about this thing. Here's why I want to talk about it. Here's the thing. Let's talk about what a different thing might be that could be really great for all of us here. That, when you put it like that, it's not that scary.
I must admit, when you said they're toxic people, when I look at, and I have shared this with our senior veterinary team and veterinary leadership teams, the people that are on the leadership teams, about a good 75% of them are the ones that were a pain in our friggin' ass for years.
Yep.
And it was like, there were times when I was like, oh my God, you were so toxic, I'm just going to fire you right now. But I can't fire you right now because we've got a HR department and they make everything relating to firing people impossible. But then they go through a phase,
yeah,
and they come out the other end and they're like, oh, wow, I don't know. I listened to a podcast. Someone told me that I was like being a little brat. And yeah, so like, for me, I see the value in people when they go through this journey.
Yeah.
Because in a way, they're not necessarily toxic, but they kind of like stand up for something, but they haven't really learned how to express a voice in the right way. They haven't yet learned how to harness the influence that they generate in an effective manner to have effective impact and change. So I always feel like as if that it's my responsibility or responsibility of leadership teams to find the influential people, the ones who, you know, kind of are toxic at the start, and then shift guide, have tough discussions and whatever it may be. But I shit you not, there are times when there are toxic people in our business. I'm like, God, well,
it's often, isn't it? The thorn in the side, the hard one to manage is very often they care and they have the courage.
They care. They take care. That's exactly it.
They have the courage to be a pain in your ass.
Yes, exactly right.
So I like that. I like this. This is something that we can work with here. We need something that's a definition of toxic and what's not, because I think some of the behavior you're describing is unchanneled, unbridled enthusiasm, passion, but it's not yet found its home. It's not yet found its direction. And at that passion, when it comes out, that's conflict. And people, oh God, we're in conflict with this again. It's such a pain in the bum. Okay. I think toxicity is where you're, I think there are things that are, is asking ourselves a question, is this thing an assault on our culture, on what we're trying to achieve here? And there's behaviors that are passionate and not uncoordinated, but unchanneled or inappropriate. And I would, Gerardo, I would put myself 100% in that category. I must have been an gigantic pain in the ass for every boss I work for. And undoubtedly, I would have considered firing me. No, but there's just no question in my head, because I was not, I had enthusiasm to burn, energy to burn, great fun. Absolutely.
And you were loud. And I'm sure you spoke up all the time.
Such a pain in the arse. and lived the values on my sleeve, but always wanted, was very loyal and committed to the practices I worked for. Anything I did was because I wanted it to succeed. There's such a difference between that and people who gossip, for example. Like, gossip to me is one of the most cardinal sins in the assault on a culture. An attack on the values is always, there's a difference. Conflict, caring, being passionate isn't an attack on values. It's maybe not in this core group of values anyone has or a practice has, but it's just something that's being expressed, and that combined with a lack of emotional intelligence can show up as a pain. Now that person is going to turn into the yous or the me's or whoever of tomorrow, given the right channeling, given the right support, given the right experiences. And that's probably our job as leaders, is to funnel and bridle or direct or steer that energy in a way that person can self-actualize and become really useful. And that might not be within our practice, but man, if you can be a good part in that person's journey, like I love talking about the practices I worked for when I was a graduate, because they helped me. I don't consider everywhere I worked was an important part of making me who I am today. The good experiences, the bad experiences, it's all part of it. We don't get to change it. I'm not going to speak ill of it. That can be a valuable tool, but toxic, where people gossip, toxic, where people attack, toxic, where people start rounding up other people to believe what they believe and make their subculture, that is a problem.
Okay, that's it. Like, I think you hit the nail in the coffin there, which is the subculture, this kind of group within groups,
yeah.
The group that sabotages the group, but the people who are standing up, who want to make a change,
yeah.
Who want to step up and to make a difference, and then they kind of cut them down underneath and so forth.
Yes, exactly. Those are the people that, again, they have their own agenda. If you've articulated what the vision is and where you want them to be, you may get them to move your direction a little bit. But if the leopard spots keep showing up and they're not the right spots for your culture, then it's time to have the conversation, the come to Jesus moment where you're like, listen, it's time to make a decision. You're either part of this or you're not. Your choice. But what's happening now cannot continue. Because if, as a leader, if we allow that toxic behavior to continue, as Dermot said, our culture will degrade. We will look as leaders like we are, not that we're not powerful, that's not the right word, but that we're not effective as leaders, and trust in leadership from the whole team will degrade because other people will be suffering from these effects of culture. And nobody wants to work in a toxic culture. Some people are unaware of their contribution to culture. Some people are very aware. And if they're very aware and not aligned with culture, that's a problem. Those guys, to me, have to go.
Mm. Mm.
Your point of we're scared to do it because how will we find replacements?
And these guys are often like high performing, high energy people. Ooh, yeah. Who want to like boom, 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 make a difference, right?
Yep.
So they're often really engaged with the team. They're often really engaged with the clients, and they, you know, they make the business money because they work hard, they work fast, and they kind of connect and do a good job, right?
So there we go. There's a brilliant cultural clash. We've got on one hand a value perhaps that says we care, and then on the other hand we've got somebody who makes money who blatantly abuses we care value but shows we make loads of money. And actually our value isn't we care. Our value is we need to make money, and we value our downtime. That's okay to value your downtime, because if you like get rid of this person, you're going to have to work more to recover them. But isn't it coming from a mindset of scarcity to say, I'll never find somebody who could be a better fit culturally, who we could grow into that role and do that? Or what about the other team members who are operating 20, 25? I've seen team members operating 50% capacity because they just can't work with a toxic person and they hate coming to work, who suddenly flourish when that person is replaced. You know, it's a fear-based thing that we hold on to them, but it's also an expression of an actual deep value. Our values are not in alignment with what we're saying about our culture. If we tolerate those people, everybody sees it. And now everybody gets to call bullshit on your culture. And now we don't have an employer brand. That's why we can't hire people. Flip it around, do the brave thing, take the pain short term, but tell your story as you go, and you won't have problems hiring people.
I got a question here. Okay, so you're talking to employer brand. Okay, so when you're saying this person has a toxic influence on your culture, and then if you don't get rid of them, it's going to impact your employer brand. Is it because that the people, because maybe 50-60% of the times, people who come and work with you come because of someone else that's already been there that has said things about the practice and so forth, that these potential advocates for your business, these potential advocates for recruitment don't want to speak up because of the fact that, you know, your brand's not out there, but your advocates aren't out there either.
Just on that, like when we're looking at the numbers that we've been sort of studying within this, like when we're looking at recruitment, you know, practices that have more, it looks like practices that have more effective recruitment policies have better cultures, but you could flip that right around and say, well, actually the practices, it's the same numbers, the practices have better cultures actually have an easier time recruiting people into their practices. And although there's a recruitment crisis going on, when we talk to these practice leaders, there's, you know, 4 out of 10 of the practices responded and said they had no issue with recruitment at all, and there must be a reason for that. So that, you know, 6 out of 10 have trouble, and that makes sense because it's widely reported. But actually, you know, just under half of these practices don't have an issue as it is. And I think have the workplace culture that you have and the reputation that builds for having, you know, for being a nice place to work, for, you know, being a practice that you can, you know, get enjoyment and fulfillment out of your job in, must make the recruitment side of it easier. And I imagine it's a little of both. If you've good and effective recruitment processes in place so that you can attract the right people, you'll have more staff and be better staffed and be better able to cope with the work that you're doing, and that makes sense. But also, if you've got a good culture and everyone who works with you goes out and tells everyone they know about how much they enjoy where they work, that's bound to make bringing people into the practice easier as well. You know, the two are linked, and there's probably no way to separate them completely.
Oh, there's a whole like other hour on employer brand we could dig into because it's such a fascinating space.
Let's go employee brand though. Hubert's like, no, I'm kidding.
On that topic, at any point, Dave or Dermot, if you've got to go, let me know and we'll start wrapping up. But we can literally go forever on all of this stuff. Have you got time for a quick left turn?
Yeah.
Dermot, while you're talking, I want to jump completely to the number two on the list, time. You have to have time. Can we dig deeper on that? First of all, just findings-wise, what did you guys find out about that? Yeah, some details on that.
I mean, I think time is often sort of the elephant in the room when it comes to leadership stuff. I spend most of my time every day talking to people who own or run practices or manages clinics, and everybody has a time issue. That, you know, nobody has the time that they want or feels that they have enough time to do all the leadership stuff that they want to do. And when we looked at time in general, it was the number one thing that people reported as being the barrier to effective leadership and management. And particularly when you looked at practice owners, 3/4 of the practice owners we looked at didn't have time to lead their team effectively, which means you've got 3/4 of the most influential people who can build culture and just influence the practice in general don't have enough time to do the work. And I think that's something we find generally, just speaking to anyone with a leadership position, it's probably quite an unusual profession in many ways that people, you know, the leaders in the practice aren't solely leaders. A lot of them fill an enormous clinical and administrative role as well. And I think that plays a part in development culture too. You know, it's bound to trickle down and influence everyone in the practice as well.
Like we often elevate people because they're high producers, but then they're not necessarily leaders, right? But if we give them tools and training, but also the time, because they do get caught between I'm a high producer and you like business owners almost expect these high producers to keep them producing at the same level while somehow try to increase and elevate the production of other people as well in performance management. It's so unfair.
Oh yeah. Talk about setting people up to fail. It's a shock. But we're also addicted to clinical work as vets. Like it's the way we define our success. It's the way, imagine you spent 20 years defining your success as a clinician by the number of animals you fixed, the quality of your medicine, the amount of daily revenue you generate, and now you're given this completely different ball game. But nobody's actually sat down and told you the effective impact value of that. And I think when we're talking to leaders about this, we ask people to think and rank the things they do in their day and attach the value. So what's a $10 an hour value task? What's $100 an hour value? What's $1,000, $10,000, $100,000 an hour value? And the higher up the leadership tree you go, the higher that dollar value per hour potentially can be. Like, what's the dollar value of creating vision? That's got to be in the $100,000 an hour work. What's the dollar value around building out your recruitment process? For sure, that's in $10,000 an hour work. What's clinical stuff? It's in $1,000 an hour work, roughly speaking, or 100 if you're doing consults, but you see an immediate return on that time investment.
Feels so good as well, isn't it? Because the other stuff you talk about, I even find it with my work and not even clinical work, the nuts and bolts, start a job, finish it, wrap it up stuff. It feels so important and it feels so good because you can get it done. Whereas something like, let's create the vision for my practice, feels so ethereal and doesn't feel that worthwhile necessarily. It's very hard to recognize
that. It absolutely doesn't. Exactly. So we don't invest in it, or we invest a lesser amount of time than it deserves. And I mean, culture, the thing that's breaking the whole freaking industry right now, culture or poor culture. I mean, there's systemic issues as well. It's not all culture, but it's a massive part. It's culture. And we're not able to find time to put this other thing down. We have a reflex to clinical work that is, it's almost like the desire to breathe when you're underwater running out of breath. It's so overwhelming to vets and it's so damaging. But that's one of the first things that we work on breaking with leaders is you have to let go. You have to let go. And as soon as you took a leadership role, your primary responsibility stopped being animal care. And we need some kind of Hippocratic oath that leaders take that says, my primary, my sole regard is for the well-being, welfare of my teams and my culture. And if we took that with the same level of responsibility and the same level of commitment, then we would create the space to learn, to grow. There's no problem with vets learning these skills. These are just skills. Leaders are created. They're not born freaking awesome. It's a skill set. You can learn it, whether it's emotional intelligence, delegation, feedback, vision creation. They're just bloody skills. So vets can do this. But we are reflexly prioritizing $1,000 an hour work and leaving aside because we don't recognize it. And we don't see the immediate dotted joined up link between this effort here and that reward or benefit over there. Yeah. And that's hard. That's a hard sell, guys, but it's true.
It kind of almost rolls back to the same question, which is like, what do you do when you have a toxic person that you want to get rid of, but then you have no team members to recruit? It's the short-term pain over the long-term gain.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Like I had this conversation with one of the person I was coaching. He said, I can't get rid of the person because I can't reduce my hours. I can't take myself off the roster schedule. And I'm like, well, can you really not? No way. I can't do it. The clients just keep coming. I said, what if you got COVID tomorrow and you were laid up in hospital for a month and you couldn't get relief vet cover? Like, what would happen? Oh, I'd have to close the practice. I'm like, okay, so you could do it under the circumstances if you really need, if you were forced to do it, if the decision were taken away from you, it could happen, right? Yeah, it could happen. Okay, well, there's a spectrum, and it really was this absolute bloody mindedness, commitment to the norm, to what is normal. But let's say the worst case happened, and you got rid of your toxic person, and you had to downsize or right size your business for a while, so that your P&L account didn't look very healthy. But it wouldn't mean that you wouldn't make any profit, because if you lost a few people and you needed to lose them, well, you're just in a different phase of the business cycle. But here's what, our perfectionist brains can't handle a backward step to go forward, because that looks like what? The big F word, failure.
Oh, I thought the F word was like, fuck. Sorry.
It's unusual. I'm the one swearing the least.
I couldn't think of another effort that quick.
That's it, right. That in itself requires some unpacking, Gerardo. Failure of what? Like our expectations, comparing ourselves against our peers. So what are you willing to do? Burn yourself out, run yourself into the ground, and are we en masse willing to do that at the expense of this profession we all love? No, that's crazy, but it requires boldness. And listen, COVID taught me some very interesting lessons. One was when we were mandated to stop doing a lot of and any routine work when COVID first happened. Overnight, my clinic revenue dropped 75%. Yeah, right. That.
Wow.
Now, we were going through this transition, which had meant that we were, you know, a lot of team members were leaving at the end of a journey and we were rebuilding a team for a new journey. In a sense, I was really fortunate in that timing because the wage bill dropped significantly as well. And so the practice actually benefited from that transition in that moment. And we were then able to rebuild a team and go, right, well, we've not actually got masses of work coming in. We do have the luxury of get this right, get this really, really right from here. And that's what we did and rebuilt it now. And now, you know, the practice is up 20% where it was before and the team is happy and poised for a good year this year with a really interesting plan. That couldn't have been possible. What's possible now wouldn't have been possible before with the team that was built around the first mission. And that's okay. I think practices, it is okay for you to have a defined mission that comes to an end and you make decisions about who's on the team, who's not on the team moving forward. I think that's how normal companies do things in project teams. We have a project in veterinary medicine and it's to do veterinary medicine and the project lasts forever. That's the definition of fucking exhausting. We're just scared to actively manage our businesses.
And the pain that's associated with managing people.
Yeah.
That is super freaking painful.
But it is. But listen, Gerardo, it's also super freaking awesome when you see them growing. And we're all crazy. Like every single one of us on this planet is crazy in our own way. And it's always going to be a mess.
If you don't manage people, you know what? You're just going to be doing the same shit over and over again. And you're not replacing yourself.
I suppose, speaking of time, we are probably running out of it. We need some more. I wanted to ask about influencing culture when you're not a leader. That's a whole new topic. Like there are a heap of people listening to this who are not in a leadership role.
How to do that in an effective and non-politicking way.
But again, we'll have to come back for that.
Yeah. And didn't Galen do that when she gave me that feedback?
Oh, there you go.
She was such a powerful leader as a 17-year-old kennel assistant in that moment.
Caring, the courage.
Uh-huh.
Dimit, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Dave, it's nice to see you again, man.
Pleasure, mate. I'm so glad you're feeling better, buddy.
The problem with Gerardo being back on full form is now he's back to not shutting up. And
I know. You're an editor's nightmare. I'm already thinking your editor must hate you.
That's me. I'm going to edit all
this.
Oh,
you've got to edit. Okay, there you go.
Right, let's call that a session. Dave, Dermot, Mac, Ernie, let's land this plane. Dave and Dermot, thank you so much for your time. This has been awesome. I can't believe we haven't done it before. And again, I've just sat here going, we can just talk for days. But we'll have to get you back on.
Thanks for having us. And love to get you guys across and jump on the Biz Success Show as well. We'd love to have you.
If you are a practice manager or an owner and you're looking for easy and affordable CPD options for your team, get in touch on vetworldpodcast@gmail.com about a discounted practice membership to our clinical podcasts. You will need to look long and hard to find a more useful, more affordable educational resource to make sure your team are clinically sharp so you can spend more time on important things like working on culture. And if you're not the boss, go talk to the boss and tell them you want a subscription to the VetVault Clinical.